My name's Ali, and this is the Russophiles Unite podcast, where we watch Russian films and films with some kind of Russian connection. Basically, it's an excuse for me to hang out with friends old and new and yak on and on about some films. So, as always, I'm joined by a guest, and today my guest is Patrick. Hi, Patrick.
Hello. Hi, how are you doing?
Yeah, doing all right.
Good.
So, Patrick, could you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Sure, yeah. So we are obviously mates from way back from school. Likewise, same as yourself, bit of a film nerd. So, you know, wanted to appear on the podcast, obviously. And I think the fact it's a Russian podcast, Russian films, interesting angle. Always had a bit of a fascination with kind of Russia. And I guess that probably, I don't know where it really stems from. I think I used to like looking at maps a lot, and I would see, you'd sort of see, you know, your typical map of the world, Russia, just absolutely enormous landmass, yeah. Obviously, and just kind of looking at it and thinking, how can you have a country that big? Like, do people live all over it or in all parts of it? And obviously later learning, you know, about kind of the way that, a bit more about Russia and its history, and obviously the fact that there's more kind of people in the West, and you've got Siberia and the Far East, of these sort of mysterious lands. So I guess always had kind of a, it's always been an intriguing place, I suppose. Haven't been, not yet, but supposed to be going to the World Cup.
Oh, which, super. Yeah. You've not told me about that.
No. So we were thinking probably Moscow, St. Petersburg, and interestingly enough for this podcast, Volgograd.
Oh, yes.
So the big three.
Yes. So, which I guess brings us neatly on, yes, to the topic of today's podcast. We're going to be watching the 2013 Russian film called Stalingrad. So if you're a history fan, you'll know that Volgograd is just the latest of a number of different names that it's had. Before it was Stalingrad, it was Tsaritsyn, I think. But yeah, it's so that's what we're going to be watching today. What can you tell me about Stalingrad?
Wow, where to start? Well, yeah, I studied history at uni. Didn't actually cover the Eastern Front, World War II, but I guess just through kind of wider reading on the subject, picked up a fair bit. Obviously, seen as, I suppose, the turning point in the Second World War, one of the big turning points, 1942, along with El Alamein, I guess, in North Africa.
Yeah.
But they really, obviously, if you know anything about the Eastern Front, there's not really any comparison in terms of scale of what was going on between the Russians and the Germans on the Eastern Front versus, in comparison, relatively small sideshow in North Africa and other theatres. So, yeah, obviously, you know, it was, we could go on a long time. I'm not really sure where to start, but yes, obviously it's seen as a bit of a disaster, a debacle for the German army. Obviously the Russian winter, brutal kind of street fighting and guerrilla warfare, I guess. Stories of Russian tanks being constructed in factories that were, you know, a couple of blocks away from the fighting, and then rolling out of the factory and driving straight into battle. So all these kind of legends and, stories you hear about that battle, but I guess not covered that much in kind of Western popular culture. If we're talking about films and books, I can think of a small handful, but I guess considering the scale of it and its importance in history, it seems to be kind of a bit overlooked.
I think that's definitely a fair point. But just before we start this recording, we did, when we decided on the film, we did mention that you've seen Enemy at the Gates.
Yes. So, I guess when did Enemy at the Gates come out? What was it? Probably, I don't know, 15 years ago or so?
There or thereabouts.
Yeah, so it was a reasonably kind of big film, I think, when it, at the time of release. I guess it was in the wake of stuff like Saving Private Ryan and Band of Brothers, when there was that wave of kind of films and TV around World War II and a bit more perhaps gritty and realistic in terms of its portrayal of kind of warfare, I suppose. It's not bad, Enemy at the Gates. It's got it's one of those films where if anyone listening is familiar with the work of James Horner, who is the composer on Enemy at the Gates, it's one of these ones. He had a really bad reputation for reusing and basically ripping off his own work again and again across different films. So if you listen to the soundtrack in Enemy at the Gates, it's very, very, there's stuff in there from Aliens, there's stuff in there from Star Trek, from Willow, loads of other films that he scored, basically. And he just sort of, and you start to notice, actually, I remember I'd be like sort of sitting in the cinema or watching a film at home, and I'd hear like little bits. I'm like, yeah, that's got to be James Horner doing that score again. But
hang on a minute. Yeah, I've heard this before. But, I mean, there's definitely a distinction to be made between, you know, someone having a signature style, like, I mean, John Williams is the obvious one, or, you know, Hans Zimmer, and then just what you're saying sounds like slightly different, like he's literally going...
Oh, this is just literally taking it from one film to the next, these, like, little motifs and, you know, like... Yeah, I mean, he had a reputation for it, but don't get me wrong, I think he was actually a really good film composer, but yeah, I mean, he was quite good at creating an atmosphere, I guess, but yeah, anyway, that's by the by. But in terms of Enemy at the Gates as a film, Ed Harris is very good in it as the sort of sniper, and it's obviously about this duel between these two snipers, one Russian, one German, the young Russian sniper played by Jude Law. But yeah, I mean, I guess because it focuses on that duel between the two of them, you don't perhaps get a sense of the wider kind of battle itself and maybe its significance in terms of the bigger picture, in terms of what was going on in the war at the time. So if that is the biggest, I suppose, film piece of popular culture to cover Stalingrad in the West, then we're probably not really getting the whole picture. So... yeah, it'll be interesting to see today how this kind of recent Russian version looks at it perhaps from a different angle and I'm guessing maybe on a bigger scale as well. I don't know, we'll see.
Yeah, I mean, I've seen both films, but it's a while since I've seen either, so it's kind of hard to comment, and that's definitely something I'll try and bring up in part two. It's one of those, it's a name that's sort of known, but yeah, people don't necessarily know the details. Certainly when I think about history, I'm also a big history fan. In terms of my personal history with Patrick, we were in an A-level history class together, so both distracting each other from actually learning anything, I suspect. But yeah, when I think about all the places in history that I would want to be, and all the places I definitely wouldn't want to be.
It wouldn't be high up the list of places you'd want to be.
It's kind of Stalingrad and maybe somewhere on the Western Front in World War One. In terms of just, I would rather not
sheer
be there.
Apocalyptic awfulness. I would imagine. Yeah,
yeah, or you know, maybe the sort of Black Death, medieval Europe.
It's
sort
up
of,
there with that.
It's in that like top 10. Really, wouldn't want to be someone living through this.
This is going to be a fun podcast.
It's going to be super, super, super cheery. Yes, it is.
Start with the happy stuff. Indeed.
Yeah, well, we've done a few comedies in this series. And, you know, people have...
There are Russian comedies. Comedies.
Russians laugh. I've been there. And I can attest to the fact that, you know, in spite of, like, Western stereotypes, it's not all that is not funny.
Ivan Drago kind of... Soviet Iron Man type personalities. Yeah, okay. Okay. Yeah. I believe that.
So one thing I wanted to ask you about was about your film studies A level. So when we were doing A level history, you were doing that, and of course me being a self-absorbed teenager back then, I'm not sure if I ever asked you what films you watched for your film studies.
Yeah, I think it would have been a relatively new course at the time. And it felt like a relatively easy one to pick as well. It kind of made sense on that front. But I think we did a range of stuff. We did some foreign language films. We did a very, very strange Czech film about a tree that comes to life and starts eating people. Sweet. Called Little Otic. Yeah, really, really weird one, that one. We did some British films. We did Trainspotting, even kind of American teen films. Clueless was on the syllabus.
Oh, I'm really pleased to hear that was, because that's probably one of my favourite films.
Yeah, and I think I was quite dismissive of it before watching it, but actually studying it and, you know, kind of understanding a bit about the way it was constructed and everything, and when you start breaking it down, it's a very clever film. Very rewatchable. What else do we do? I remember doing a kind of an essay on Gladiator, and on that opening scene in Gladiator, probably one of my favourite scenes of any film, really.
So just remind.
So that's the kind of the battle that Russell Crowe and the Romans have with the barbarians.
I thought that was the one we were talking about, and when they have all of that sort of fortification kind of built.
Yes,
you know.
Amazing scene, like visually stunning, and I think I think it was one of those kind of films where you started to see certain techniques coming in. So I know that Ridley Scott, the director, had used some of the techniques they'd used in Saving Private Ryan. So they would use a technique whereby they'd sort of cut frames out of the shot. So it would give a slightly almost kind of jerky effect to the footage. And when they used that in Saving Private Ryan, it was to try and call back to World War II era footage that was, captured from the battlefields. So there's all sorts of things like that. And, just visually, that scene's amazing. They filmed it in, I think it was Epping Forest, and they literally destroyed an entire part of the forest that the Forestry Commission needed to be cleared for whatever reason. And they just said to Ridley Scott, if you want to fire a load of catapults and flaming arrows into this part of the forest,
By all means,
go for it. Yeah, and unleash hell. And
on my signal.
Yeah, exactly. That scene's amazing because it's got, as well as the visuals, you've got Hans Zimmer's score that kind of just builds throughout the whole kind of scene. You've got the Germanic barbarian tribesmen who are just chanting stuff.
Really big guy coming out, and he's like the sort of champion guy,
the Conan sort of chieftain at the front. Yeah, and another sort of interesting bit of trivia on that scene. You can sort of hear the barbarians sort of chanting in the background as the Romans are kind of getting ready for battle. And Ridley Scott actually used the exact same audio track of the Zulu warriors in Zulu doing their war chants and just literally put it over the top. So you can almost hear them kind of shouting like Zulu. If you've listened very, very closely, he just took the exact same audio from it and just reused it. But it kind of works really well. It just, that scene just builds and builds and builds to that sort of opening battle. Did a whole essay on that. And
the problem is you're making me want to rewatch that instead of watching that.
It was on TV about two nights ago, so yeah, it's still kind of fresh in my mind at the moment. But film studies. I'm guessing it's probably quite a common A-level subject now. People probably, a lot more people probably doing film at uni and going on to film schools and stuff like that. But at the time, it felt quite kind of fresh and new. And I guess it just kind of added to the level of geekery and nerdiness around films that was already building at the time.
As if there wasn't enough to begin with. I was going to ask also, do you feel like it changed the way that you watched films in a big way that sort of continues to now? Because we're now talking about like half your lifetime ago half my lifetime ago as well.
Yeah. Interesting question. I think possibly there was some... I mean, this is A level. It's not film school. There are certain techniques and things that I suppose I might perhaps be more conscious of now. Mise-en-scène, that always sticks with me. That
I can never
expression.
Remember what that means. Can you just explain
God.
That?
Now you're putting
me on the spot.
Put me on the spot. Yeah, I think it's the sort of construction of a scene. It's the minutiae of what's going on in the background and how that kind of relates to conveying a mood, all that kind of...
Gotcha.
Does that seem about right?
Yeah, it's one of those ones which I always read it. I look it up every so often because I can't remember what that means.
Hmm.
And Yeah, that sounds similar, but it's a bit slippery, which is probably why you just have this set term. Sort of a bit of a catch-all.
I think there was part of the syllabus was looking at auteurs as well, and kind of, you know, how certain filmmakers have a particular style, whether that's visually or thematically, you know, and you can see that through their body of work, and perhaps I pay a bit more attention now to certain directors who you start to notice kind of patterns and themes and the same styles appearing across their body of work in a way that I might not have done otherwise. But, you know, ultimately, I think, you know, I still go and see crappy blockbusters, you know, as much as the next person. I discovered a few kind of filmmakers, I suppose, around that time, people like who would be more, you know, considered to be auteurs if there are any left in Hollywood. Mm. So people like Terrence Malick, who was kind of one of the directors who I was kind of starting to become aware of around that time, and you know, someone who's a real artist almost, you know, and a bit of an outsider within that Hollywood system. It was a good course, and I guess it's helped kind of grow my love for film ever since.
Oh, that's cool. I mean, speaking of auteurs, or people who might be considered as such.
Oh, it's auteurs, is it? Not auteurs. you're probably right. I'm gonna say you're right. Yeah.
I don't care. Whatever. Christopher Nolan. Some people talk about him as being one. And to wrap it round back to sort of World War II films, have you seen Dunkirk yet?
Yeah, I haven't seen it yet, to my shame.
See it at the cinema, I know, if you can.
Did you? Yeah, you didn't see it at IMAX though, did you?
No, just regular cinema.
No, I'd like to see it. I've heard it's got this kind of suspense, and again, Hans Zimmer, isn't it, doing it with the soundtrack? It kind of builds all the way.
Going back to composers.
Builds all the way through the film. I'd love to see it. Is it good?
It's really, really good for just having seen quite a few war films at this point. It's relatively, sounds pretentious, but it's relatively singular in terms of what it's trying to do. Although it does remind me, in terms of its relative uniqueness, quite of Andrei Tarkovsky's Ivan's Childhood. It is very different, but the one thing that's similar is, if memory serves anyway, it's a while since I've seen Ivan's Childhood, is that it's really focusing on one side. Like, you don't see all that much of the Germans. They're kind of like a threat in the distance for the most part.
Yes.
It's really, really good. It's really, really claustrophobic. And yeah, it just really makes you feel the helplessness
of the situation
that you must imagine that people felt. Yeah, it's claustrophobic despite being set in these this sort of wide open beach.
Yes.
Which is quite a thing to create.
An atmosphere to have created. Yeah, okay, no, I do want to see it. There's a very good scene in, I think it's Atonement, where it was quite a famous kind of tracking shot of the Dunkirk beaches, and the camera kind of pans, must be sort of close to like 6 or 7 minutes long, where it just pans through the sort of chaos of the beach. And I think I heard that Christopher Nolan was quite kind of influenced by that when he was, you know, after seeing that, to want to go on and build on that for Dunkirk. So no, I'd like to see it.
Yeah. So in terms of the film we're watching today, it'll be interesting to see, because it's Stalingrad and it's close quarters street fighting, whether this does a good job of capturing that sense
kind of atmosphere.
Claustrophobia. Mm.
Cool.
So we're going to launch into the film, and I'm going to do what I do to all of my guests. I'm going to make you say some Russian, and the bit of Russian I'm going to make you say is «Поехали».
Okay. Well, go for it now.
Yep, but I'll explain it is.
With my hammiest Russian pronunciation as well.
Exactly. So, «Поехали» is what Yuri Gagarin said when he was blasting into orbit. He was blasting off, becoming the first man in space.
Meaning?
Meaning, off we go. So it's a little bit, okay. It's right. A little bit prosaic, but in terms of the Russian language, it's something you say all the time, but because of when he said it, it's similarly iconic to One Small Step for
yes.
Man, okay. But it's less of a nice like one. Set piece, I guess, than that is. Yeah.
Okay, well, without further ado, Поехали!
Поехали! Just watched Fyodor Bondarchuk's Stalingrad, and I don't know, Patrick, if you've seen I kind of want to get this out of the way straight away, the Monty Python and Hilda sketch.
I haven't, no.
Okay, so it's one basically. Yeah, it's one basically where somehow all of the Nazis have survived the war and they're in like late '60s, early '70s, Minehead, and they're sort of. masterminding the overthrow of the country, and so they're staying at this like B&B, and the proprietor sort of comes over and sees them looking at all these maps, and she goes, "Ooh, Stalingrad! You won't have much fun in Stalingrad." to which John Cleese goes, "No, not much fun in Stalingrad," and that's, you know. While being very flippant, it's kind of how I feel about this film so far.
Okay.
But I just wanted to get that out of the way because, you know, obviously it's a fairly serious subject.
Yes, well, that's the trouble, isn't it? I think we were kind of saying earlier. It's difficult to talk about. Sometimes these kind of films can be a little bit overblown, and there can be certain scenes. We'll come on to it later, I'm sure, but where. You almost wanted to laugh, maybe, but actually, when you're thinking about the subject matter, it's really not very long ago. We're talking, 70, 80 years ago.
Yeah.
You know, it's you know, they're still within people's living memory. So, yeah, it's a bit of a weird one, isn't it?
Absolutely. Kind of films. But before we get into, like, that discussion, could you give us a quick sort of rundown of what happens?
Okay, so... Essentially, the film begins. There's a little kind of prologue where some Russian kind of rescuers, I guess, are flying out to Japan. There's been a tsunami, and there's some German people who are trapped underneath a collapsed building. And one of the rescuers is speaking to one of the people who's trapped under the building, and he's speaking to them in German, even though he's a Russian.
Conveniently.
Yep. And then we sort of the Russian the rescuer sort of mentions that he had five fathers, and the German person who's rescuing says how can someone have five fathers, and then we sort of cut back to Stalingrad, 1942. A group of Russian soldiers are crossing the Volga River,
or preparing to cross,
from the eastern side to the western side, where the city of Stalingrad sits. And the story follows this kind of group of five soldiers. So they, you know, they obviously have other kind of comrades who are with them along the way and who don't survive. But this sort of core group stays through most of the film, and we see them sort of street fighting against the Germans and moving through the city and eventually sort of arriving around a sort of what looks like the town square. Kind of central area, city centre, which is, you know, sort of part of it is controlled by the Germans and part of it by the Russians. And there's sort of this standoff in the centre of the city and kind of, I guess, a no man's land between the two forces. And yeah, the rest of the action kind of unfolds from there, really. Pretty brutal stuff in parts.
Not an easy
watch.
no, as you know, as you'd expect. Yeah, so essentially they're kind of trying to hold out a bridgehead in the city, and they also it's a former apartment building with, you know, one surviving resident who's like an 18-year-old girl, and they take her under their wing. And so a lot of the rest of the film is them trying to defend this building, but also they're forming this relationship with her, and she's kind of like the glue that binds the group together.
And then conversely, you've got, it also touches on the story of a German soldier who is, I don't know whether he's having an affair or if it's a little bit less consensual than an affair. Possibly at first.
Yeah.
It is. With a Russian woman who is sort of seen by her countrymen as kind of a collaborator, isn't she? She's not particularly well treated by either side, to be honest. So you've got these two groups. You've got the five Russian soldiers and Katya, this woman who's this Russian girl who's been caught up in the fighting and whose apartment is the sort of the centre of the action. And then you've got the German officer and is it Masha?
The Russian girl, short for Maria. Yeah. Mm. So just to pick up on the sort of overblownness, that's something I definitely felt. And I felt like, almost rushing to the end here, but overall, the film kind of won me over by the end, but there was a lot towards the beginning when I was kind of rolling my eyes a bit,
yes,
which felt really awkward and awful, because you know this is a depiction of something that happened in real life, so you don't want to feel like you're treating...
No, 100%. I know exactly what you mean, and I think, yeah, the word overblown did come to my mind as well at a few points whilst I was watching it. I mean, you know, the budget for this was clearly pretty high. It's got good production values. It doesn't look shoddy. It's not a Hollywood production, but certainly in terms of budget, it looks like it could be visually. It's impressive. You know, they've obviously built some kind of real sets, and you know, there's a lot of CGI in there, but it's pretty good quality. Like you, I guess where you were saying about it being overblown, what I noticed, a lot of the kind of the action sequences, they've got this really kind of irritating slow-mo effect.
Yeah.
Almost, and Carrie, who was watching it with us, Ali's wife, she said it's almost like, it looks like a video game in parts.
Yeah, that was definitely the thing for me that made it in the realms of like the slightly eye-rolly thing. And I don't know whether that's just snobbery on my part, but I kind of feel like, I know, especially with war films, when it's about real wars, the historical wars, I kind of don't like that stuff. I mean, if it's something that's a fictitious scenario, it doesn't bother me so much.
Almost seems a bit inappropriate, doesn't it?
Yeah, exactly. Inappropriate is the word. Yeah, it feels like it's trivialising, and it's kind of like, a friend of mine, when talking about The Matrix, obviously this is going back a few years, called it cool violence, which definitely suffers from some cool violence. There's one point where somebody, you pointed out, like a soldier stabs one of the German guys and sort of twists the knife as it goes in.
In a very stylized kind of way.
Yeah. And you said, like, why does he need to do that? And I'm kind of like, it just looks more badass.
Because he's a Nazi.
He deserves it.
I agree with that completely. And I think there were visually parts of it that you can see that the mostly negative influence of this film cropping up again and again in action films now, but 300. So the sort that thinking back, I think that was one of the first films where you started to see the where action sequences would suddenly be slowed down.
Yeah.
To you know, kind of very moving through the frames very slowly as some sort of like ludicrous kind of stabbing or decapitation is occurring, and those kind of things do crop up in this film, and given the subject matter, it does seem a little bit silly, and almost actually it takes away slightly from the brutality and the visceral nature of those scenes, because it's just so stylized and video gamey.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and there are some things which kind of pull you back and you kind of think, wow, that's an interesting decision. Like, you have towards the end, the Russian soldiers are pretending to be dead, and one guy like basically cuts one of the corpses that they're hiding amongst and covers himself with some blood to make it more like he's dead. And I'm kind of going, see, that comes across as like that's something that somebody might have done and is a bit more real. In terms of like the slightly stupid things, there's this one bit quite early on where this woman is collared by the Germans and they say, "You're a Jew, aren't you?" And she's like, no. But they obviously ignore this. And then they essentially put her in the back of like a trailer or some kind of... It almost looks like a caravan.
Mm.
And then they proceed to burn her alive. And this is just in plain sight of the housing block. And of course, understandably, the Russian soldiers get really, really angry. And then they come sort of charging out of the building. And somehow they manage to overcome the Germans despite, you know, essentially running into machine
traps.
And a few of them die, but basically they see them off. And you just kind of go, that just doesn't ring... rings true that they would have been really, really angry and want to go and kill them, but at the same time, they wouldn't... It would have been too great a risk and they wouldn't have sold their lives that cheaply.
No. That did seem slightly unrealistic, that scene. It was interesting as well, that we mentioned Enemy at the Gates.
Yes.
The town square, my memory of Enemy at the Gates, it looked like a very similar sort of set. So you had, it must presumably be taken from pictures of Stalingrad from the 40s, but there's sort of this very iconic statue kind of in the middle of the square of some children holding hands and kind of dancing. And I remembered that from Enemy at the Gates, and you sort of see it again here. So presumably both of them are fairly accurate and have actually used kind of, you know, it visually it's probably pretty historically accurate.
Mm.
And as I say, certainly it looked like it had some money behind it as a production.
Yeah. Just talking about that that particular scene that I was mentioning where the Jewish woman is burnt alive, that reminded me of an incident from Vasily Grossman's Life and Fate. And I think whoever wrote the script must have... they certainly would have read Life and Fate, just because there's a few incidents that are quite similar. And then Vasily Grossman, as well as being a novelist, he was originally a journalist, and he, you know, travelled around with the Red Army during the war. So it might be just a coincidence, and they'd just read similar stories or, you know, heard similar accounts. But there's something very similar in that. I haven't actually read the original book, but the BBC did a fantastic radio adaptation of it not that long ago. I guess it's 3 or 4 years, so probably not far from when this came out. And the scenario is very similar. Someone's going to be burnt alive, but instead of, you know, going out all guns blazing, the Russians, they either call in an artillery strike or they, you know, launch mortars at the Germans themselves, but they don't, you know, run out and essentially...
Rambo style.
Yes, exactly. So we talked quite a bit about the more negative side or you know, things that weren't done so well. What did you like about this film, if anything?
I think, you know, visually, I said it before, it's strong on that front. You know, the way that the sets are dressed, the city looks suitably apocalyptic and decrepit. It really feels like a war zone. The characters, I mean, some of them were fairly one-dimensional, and, you know, I wouldn't say there's a huge kind of character arc for many of them. I'd say some of the more interesting ones are probably Katya, the Russian girl whose apartment is caught up in the middle of this chaos. She's treated by the Russian soldiers. You know, again, I'm not sure how true that rings to history. You know, if you were a woman caught up in a war zone like this, I'd imagine it would be absolutely terrifying. And it, you know, they're very sort of honourable and chivalrous around her. A few sort of comments are made early on, but generally they're sort of very respectful of her, and really kind of look after her. And that I guess that kind of relationship that they have with her is the only sort of warmth and humanity to be found in this film, really, amongst all this sort of death and destruction. And there's a really nice scene, I thought, where they have a birthday party to celebrate, I think it's her 19th birthday, 18th birthday. And that did seem like a sort of a genuinely quite a well shot scene, and you know, they sort of bake a cake for her and you know, kind of sing songs and stuff. So that was a rare moment of kind of warmth, when you did sort of get a sense that these were possibly three-dimensional human beings rather than just kind of soldiers shouting, "Let's kill these bastards." One particular scene, the scene you referenced, where they sort of run out into the square and slaughter the German soldiers. So yeah, it had a few moments like that were a bit more kind of human, but otherwise it was a bit of a slog, wasn't it, in parts?
Yeah, I mean, again, it's difficult to fault. And I don't think this is what you're doing, fault a film about Stalin for being a slog. You know,
it's not going to be sunshine, lollipops and rainbows, really, is it? Let's face it.
Yeah, I mean, if you come away from a film about Stalingrad going, "Wow, wasn't that a lark?" then it's probably not really
very
done
true
its job properly. But yeah, sort of pedantry aside, yeah, I like that scene as well. Although I can definitely see people taking against it as well. Just, I think there were quite a few times where the music really, really irritated me. It was just a bit maudlin and sentimental, and just they were using too much of it.
Mm. I mean, you know a lot more about Russian cinema than I do, Ali, but I suppose my stereotypical Westerner view is that type of sort of orchestral, almost kind of ambient, it's sort of very quite an ambient, because it's in a lot of scenes. As a sort of, I get the sense that's quite common in Russian cinema, in a way that perhaps it isn't in kind of Western Hollywood productions, or not anymore, maybe, anyway. But I might be wrong.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, certainly, I haven't seen a ton of Russian war films. Part of the reason for doing the podcast is to watch more Russian films. But one thing that's really good about Andrei Tarkovsky's Ivan's Childhood, which I think I referred to in the intro, is there's very little ambient music. And that's generally a thing I've noticed with his films. He does use a bit, but it's quite sparing. Whereas this, it kind of almost any time, it was kind of sticking it on with a trowel a bit. We're supposed to be talking about the positive stuff, and I'm just slagging the film off again.
What did you think of the portrayal of the Germans, in particular the German officer, Kahn, was it? Captain Kahn?
Peter Kahn. Mm. Yeah, we only really get two German characters that have any time spent on them, which is, Captain Kahn, and then his, I think it's a colonel above him. I didn't catch his surname, but the rest are just kind of, they're just cannon fodder infantry guys, really, who almost say nothing. And there is a differentiation. I don't know that you'd say they're really fully fleshed characters, but the colonel is like a proper full-on Nazi, and he talks about kind of cleansing the area and just
scum and filth, how he refers to the Russians.
Yeah, and there are bits where the Captain Kahn does kind of parrot that sort of thing. Like when he's talking to Masha, he's kind of like, "Oh, you know, you Russians, you're barbarians, and like, what have you done to me?" But there's something about just the tone of voice and the expressions where you don't know whether he actually really believes what he's saying. Yeah, I mean, we've talked about it a little bit already, but that relationship is super uncomfortable, because initially, like you said, it's quite non-consensual. You think she's kind of just going along with it because she's not really got any choice, but you do seem like towards the end there's a bit more of a
mutual respect between the two of them,
or at least affection, maybe. And spoiler alert, but things do not end well for anyone, but Masha is picked off by one of our Russian guys in the apartment building. She basically comes out to say to Captain Khan, don't go, come back. And that gives the Russian sniper his chance. And he basically shoots her. And he's seen her about a few times. And he has, just basically nothing but contempt for her.
Mm.
It's interesting the differentiation, sort of going back to the Russian characters. I know we're kind of flip-flopping all over the place, but there seems to be, there is some differentiation about how they all feel about the war and how they feel about the enemy, which was quite interesting.
I was struggling to distinguish between a couple of them at different points. I mean, you've obviously got one of the Russian soldiers is a sniper, and he sort of, his attitude seemed to be perhaps the most kind of aggressively anti-German. He has his reasons. You get a bit of backstory about from the narrator about why that is. There's an attempt made to kind of flesh out some of their characters and backstories. Given the number of soldiers that it's trying to sort of cover in two hour film, you don't get a great deal. We learn that one of the soldiers was a tenor, an opera tenor before the war, and during the birthday party scene, he sort of he sings for Katya. At the same time, I didn't really think that there was a huge amount of differentiation between them, if I'm being perfectly honest. But obviously, when you're sort of watching something with subtitles, as I was, and obviously not being able to understand it in the Russian, your eyes sort of always, you know, kind of drawn to those subtitles, and you're not perhaps not paying as much attention as you would to the characters and putting the words to the characters, if that makes sense on screen. But
I totally understand where you're coming from. I found that I was somewhat reliant on the subtitles as well. Certainly when you have lots of fast dialogue, but I thought there was one particularly interesting bit where Katya has this sniper guy, I think his name is Chvanov, teach her how to use the sniper rifle, and it ends up with her killing this German soldier as he's essentially filling up his I was going to say watering can, but
canteen.
Mm. There we go. Yeah, watering can. There's not really much time for sort of
light gardening.
Yeah, light gardening. Yeah. Yes. So that causes a bit of a falling out between Chvanov and the
Gromov.
Yeah, mm. Who is the leader of the of this group of Russian soldiers, and he says essentially, you know, don't shoot them when they're going for water. You know, that's
it's sort of a code of honour, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's still being adhered to by at least a few of the soldiers, even though it's an appalling situation and very, very brutal kind of fighting.
Yeah, although that's kind of interesting coming from him, because Gromov, quite early on, you have this Russian sailor who's kind of mixed in with the group. And when Gromov is detailing what they're going to be doing, this sailor guy says, well, you guys can all do that. I'm going to go off and find my unit. You can't tell me what to do. And Gromov orders, I think it's Nikiforov, Sasha, the singer, to shoot him, which he does. And it's quite cold-blooded. In some ways, you kind of see that the sailor was being totally insubordinate. But
he doesn't really hesitate, does he?
No, it's like bang, you're dead. and one of the other Russians, he's the guy, he's the sort of the older guy of the group, says, you know, why'd you do that?
Mm.
So there's kind of differentiation, and although that was brutal, I thought it was good that they were acknowledging that life as a Soviet soldier could be quite brutal, not just in terms of the fighting, but
yes,
also
from your own side.
Yeah, the sort of quote unquote military discipline, and certainly, you know, when you read or listen to histories of how things were done at that point, that seemed quite true to life. And for a Russian film to
to depict that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, being less than fully honourable was you know, quite refreshing. Although it's difficult to know how whether the filmmakers are saying, you know, this is good, he deserved it, or whether this is just something that happened. Similarly with Masha getting shot, you're not quite sure how
sympathetic the audience, presumably a Russian audience primarily,
is meant to feel
towards her. Yeah,
yeah,
yeah. I similarly was wondering that, how, I mean, clearly there is some sympathy for her, and I think a kind of an acknowledgement that people were collaborators for reason, not just because they were terrible human beings, but yeah. You know, occasionally in these kind of circumstances, you know, you can kind of understand why people in some cases did collaborate. So yeah, like you, I wasn't quite sure how we were meant to feel.
Yeah.
Maybe you could sort of take it either way.
Yeah. Just to take you up on the use of the word collaborate, because it's not like she's helping the Germans militarily, at least as far as I can recall. It's essentially she's just not rejecting.
She's not resisting.
Yeah, or not very much, which is just, you know, you kind of think self-preservation, really. She's not portrayed as being, you know, an out-and-out traitor in the sense of helping the Germans in kind of accomplishing their military goals. But and the definition back then of what counted as being a traitor was pretty much anything that Stalin sort of wanted it to be. I feel like at this point we should bring in a little bit of... we've both listened to a podcast series by Dan Carlin. It's part of his broader, like, hardcore history series called Ghosts of the Ostfront, which goes into the sort of World War II in this sort of Eastern theatre. And it's been really interesting watching a film having heard some of those stories, you know, kind of comparing and contrasting with, you know, that background. Actually, talking about Nikiforov, the opera singer, that reminds me of an incident that's talked about in Ghosts of the Ostfront, where they're talking about this one opera singer who was with a Russian unit, and apparently the Germans who were nearby liked to hear him perform as well. And at one point they were close enough that they were able to throw a harmonica. And then later on, when this singer would normally have performed, he was absent. The Germans supposedly sent over a message saying, "What did you do with your singer?" Because apparently he'd got a sore throat. So it was kind of interesting. I don't know whether that was specifically meant to be referencing that particular guy.
Possibly.
But it was interesting that something like that was worked in.
Quite possibly, yeah. Yeah, and Ghosts of the Ostfront, I mean, that is a podcast that really gives you a sense of the scale of the conflict on the Eastern Front. You know, there's a figure in that podcast that really sticks out to me, and the presenter, Dan Carlin, says that 8 out of 10 German soldiers that died in the Second World War died on the Eastern Front. And when you think about all the sort of great battles in North Africa and Italy, you know, in Normandy and all the way through kind of Western Europe after D-Day, as the Allies were moving through Northwest Europe, that statistic is just gobsmacking. I mean, you know, 80% of their casualties were in the East. And you realise what it makes you realise is the Russians refer to the Second World War as the Great Patriotic War. And it's... The casualties that they suffered, I think, what was it, 20 million? It was...
The estimates, no one knows.
No, and that's probably possibly at the lower end of the estimates. But, you know, when you sort of compare it to the casualties, which are pretty well known for the UK, I think, or British Empire, British forces, was I think, around 300,000 people.
Yeah.
Still, obviously, a huge loss of life. But there really is kind of no comparison. So... when you consider all that, and in the context of this film, this is obviously a Russian production. This event, Stalingrad, the Battle of Stalingrad, and the Eastern Front, and the war in the East more broadly, just clearly means a great deal to the Russian people in a way that possibly quite difficult for us to understand perhaps just seeing it as merely another battle, albeit an important one and a big one.
Yeah, and it is interesting because, you know, as British people, I mean, it's not like we think about World War II all the time, but it is quite a defining mark in our history. I think one of the things with recent, you know, political events in this country is that we do tend to think of ourselves, or we can, as a bit like we resisted the Germans at the point where everybody else gave in to them. It's kind of like, well, yeah, we also had a moat. So yeah, certainly it's really good to be seeing a film that does depict things from the Russian side. It's just a shame it isn't a bit more satisfactory, I guess.
Do you know how the film was received in Russia?
No, actually. that's a bit of a dead end.
We can Google it afterwards.
Yeah,
you can
definitely
Wikipedia
check. But I think I did read that it was like the highest grossing Russian film to date at that point, but I don't know whether that's specifically in Russia or worldwide or quite what. But yeah, I've been very down on the film, but I think it's still, I don't know, I think I'm glad I rewatched it.
Yeah, it's certainly well made. It's whether or not the characterizations are a little bit thin, I think, as we discussed.
Could say that's quite a common thing with war movies.
Tricky with war films it's the action sequences were fairly kind of drawn out in some cases, and I think, you know, possibly could have had a bit more time to flesh out some of the characters and their motivations a little bit more clearly.
I think, just going back to another of the film's problems, is that the framing device was a little bit weird, and I felt that quite often when you had the narration coming back in, that it would have been better just letting the camera focus on what's actually happening on screen rather than going, well, and then something else, detail, backstory. And it's kind of like, on the one hand, it is kind of useful to get these characters' backstory, but it might have been better to find some way of working that into the interaction of the
characters.
Yes. Because it just takes you out of it. And I think that was one of the things that I found unsatisfactory about it, is I didn't... Again, it's partly the problem of watching it at home, you know, rather than seeing something at a cinema.
Yeah.
It isn't going to be as immersive.
As immersive, no.
So maybe I'm being unfair in kind of comparing this to Dunkirk, which I saw at the cinema. But that sort of really sort of sucked you in, whereas this kept doing little things to take you out.
On that point, I don't think they'd really done enough in terms... In the prologue sequence where we don't even really meet the narrator. He's perhaps in the prologue for 5 minutes or less.
We see his back.
We don't see his face. And then when his narration comes back in, once the clock's wound back to 1942, I think initially I wasn't entirely sure that it was meant to be the guy that we'd just seen at the beginning of the film. It was. I don't think they'd done enough to sort of earn the audience's comprehension there around who was actually narrating. Obviously, you sort of, you know, twigged a little bit later on in the film, but we've got this prologue sequence, and then at the very end, we return back to the scene of this tsunami in Japan. And I think I expected there to be, you know, a 5-10 minute kind of epilogue to kind of wrap things up, where we learn a little bit more about the narrator and perhaps get a bit more interaction between our narrator and the German survivors who are stuck under this building that he's trying to rescue them from. But it sort of wraps up very, very quickly at the end. I wonder if more footage was shot for that and perhaps just cut out for whatever reason. But the usefulness of that as a framing device, I thought, was a bit dubious, because we don't really return for very long at the end of the film to that scene.
Yeah, absolutely. And especially now, as the that disaster in Japan that is depicted I think it's the Fukushima one. It's meant
possibly
to be.
Meant to be, yeah, yeah. Or reference to it.
Yeah, that just as that sort of dims in the distance, it's another kind of thing that distances you from it. It's kind of like, well, this is supposed to be about Stalingrad. Why are you bringing this in?
Mm.
I guess what I took from it is that at the end they give a speech about how essentially the world does not know war because of what our fathers.
Sacrificed.
Which, you know, to be fair, yeah, I think it is good that the Soviet and the Russian part in World War II is being acknowledged a bit more, but it's just a bit tacked on at the end and very
bit ham-fisted.
Yes, yeah, it feels a bit like rah rah
rammed down your throat.
Yeah,
kind of,
not very subtle. But then I guess, you know.
Do you think there was the fact that the Russian rescuer is ironically, I guess, rescuing Germans trapped in a building, and obviously the sequences earlier in the film are a group of Russians essentially trapped in a building. Do you think there was any sense of trying to sort of say, well, now isn't it great that we all get along now, and that there's been a improvement of relations obviously between Russia and Germany, and that the Germans are kind of human beings as well? Did you think that was the point that to try and make there? Or
I think so. I mean, it's certainly no accident that that it's not just some random nationality that he's rescuing. Yeah, I think that is sort of supposed to be the point. But again, I just could have done without the whole framing device at all. I mean,
in some ways, you don't need to know that Katya is this guy's mother.
Yeah, I just feel like I'm being totally negative about this film, but it does make me want to listen to
better
yeah,
accounts of them.
Yeah, definitely. I think there was a really nice little detail right at the beginning, and I mean just as the intro narration has stopped and you're just seeing these Russian troops about to cross the river and attack the other bank, you see this really old guy, he's probably like 60, I think, talking to probably like a 15-year-old kid. And I really liked how it's showing that the Soviets were kind of having to throw everyone in.
Yes.
You know, it's the level of desperation is, you know, it's not like 18 to sort of 40 or 45-year-old guys. It's basically, if you're a man, you're going to the front.
Yeah, you're given a rifle and sent to the front.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that scene, we mentioned Enemy at the Gates, obviously a kind of a Western production of the Battle of Stalingrad, and that scene is quite similar to a depiction of the river crossing by Soviet soldiers in Enemy at the Gates. And from that film, Enemy at the Gates, there's what immediately follows is a scene where Jude Law and the rest of the Russian soldiers are being handed rifles,
it's
one rifle per two men, with I think one bullet as well.
Yeah.
And from what I've sort of subsequently read and heard, that's a bit of an urban legend. The Russians, whilst they were occasionally, I think, poorly equipped in the very early stages of the war and after the German invasion, it was certainly nowhere near that bad
by 1942.
But I think the you know, it's obviously a slightly extreme way of showing that from a kind of resources and equipment perspective, they were kind of struggling a bit, and as you say, having to throw kind of every man in almost with kind of human wave attacks as a way of kind of defending the city. It was interesting to compare those two scenes, because the Russian soldiers here are depicted as being sort of much better equipped, I would say.
Yeah.
And it's pretty desperate, it's not as the perhaps kind of the over the top depiction of what we see in Enemy at the Gates.
Yeah, but what I do remember, it's a long time since I saw Enemy at the Gates, but that isn't kind of marred by the sort of the cool violence problem to the same degree. If the fighting, I think, feels a bit more realistic.
Agreed.
Yeah, or at least maybe not realistic. I've never been in an urban firefight. Thank goodness.
You've been paintballing.
Yeah. Not quite the same, but it doesn't have the whole sort of slow-mo nonsense, because right after that river crossing scene, it's probably the most ridiculous thing that happens, is you have all of these Soviet soldiers basically on fire and continuing to run towards the German troops, and like, maybe you might have had in real life somebody being on fire and continuing to run for a bit, but they managed to cover an awful lot of ground while still on fire and still shooting.
Mm.
And I guess it's supposed to say, kind of, look how brave these guys were. They were, you know, and it's like, yeah, I think you just need to find a slightly subtler way of showing that people were brave and, you know. Yeah, I feel like I'm probably nitpicking.
No, there were a few scenes that sort of seemed to stretch credibility a little bit, like that scene that you described with the soldiers on fire. There's another one where the Russians fire an artillery gun around a corner, essentially. So they fire the gun at a tank, and the shell bounces off the side of the tank and goes around the corner from ricocheting to hit this German position. There's another scene where a Russian soldier uses a metal bathtub as a sort of shield as he's kind of going out across no man's land. And you know, just going back to Dan Carlin's podcast, It Goes to the Ostfront, when I was watching those scenes, I was reminded of some of the more interesting anecdotes from that podcast. And it did make me wonder, actually, whether, whilst they seem slightly ludicrous and unbelievable, I wonder if they're so ridiculous almost, they are actually referencing things that did happen, or were reported from the battle. Because there's certainly a lot of kind of crazy anecdotes in that podcast.
Yeah. So I guess we could sum up by saying, don't necessarily watch this film, but do definitely check out that podcast. And I would also say, if you can get hold of the BBC adaptation of Life and Fate, or read the book. I mean, I haven't read it myself. It's not all about World War II and all about Stalingrad, but it features prominently, and it is really, really well done. So that's definitely worth looking out for. So I guess that wraps up the discussion of this film. Thanks, Patrick, very much for coming along. And
thank you for having me.
And that's all for today. Do svidaniya, folks. Hi again. Before I go, a couple of things. First is a bit of an editorial note. So it turns out the filmmakers did draw upon parts of Vasily Grossman's Life and Fate when they were writing the script. And if I'd been paying attention properly to the credits the first time, I would have spotted that, but never mind. I guess it gives me an excuse to reiterate how good the radio adaptation is. One day I might read the book. So anyway, that's that. And the second thing is, you can follow us. The Twitter handle is @RusophilesU. That's a letter U at the end. Also, there's a Facebook group, Russophiles Unite, and you can email me at russophilesunite@gmail.com. Thanks again, and do svidaniya.
Lucky Mr. Johnson pointed that out, eh? You wouldn't have had much fun in Stalingrad, would you? I said, you wouldn't have had much fun in Stalingrad, would you?
Not much fun in Stalingrad, no.